We've asked a few people to present as provocative and heretical suggestions as they can, and I hope that people will ask a lot of questions and let's have a real discussion. I think Jagan had a few remarks. You could start us off, and we'll go from there.
Okay. You know, I was asked to say something provocative and controversial, so let me try. The question is whether do we really need a gauge theory? And
this is too much. That'd be too much.
But I do have a concrete.
Let's call David Grossman.
No, not sorry, not in a compact particle, really in a condensed matter. Yeah, so it's yeah, exactly. But there is really a more concrete example. So this this question seems kind of became kind of confusing, at least. So you have heard of this interesting quantum phase, which actually carry many names, like a 2D Latinger liquid, algebra spin liquid, U1 spin liquid, deconfined phase, something like that. They have those so many names have very good physical reasons, because this phase is very interesting, actually. It have a gapless excitation, but there's no free quasi-particle. And this is very strange. If you think about the stable phase we have with the gapless excitation, all the gapless excitation are free so far. Like a spin wave at the low energy, they are free. Fermi liquid, quasi particle are free. You know,
well,
so.
No,
phase.
Phase.
Yeah. Yeah. The critical point is a difference.
He's picking up Leo's point. He's answering Leo's
point. Yeah. So, but that belongs to this strange one, you know. So there are exceptions.
Crystal rubber, you didn't.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, and but my quest point, there are such a phase exists now, that they are the quasi particles are not free, and that's be very strange, because if a quasi particle are not free, they are interacting. If they are interacting, they suppose in general have a gap. You know, why don't they have a gap? You know, that's why this is kind of strange, and this one is have a spin correlation function with some kind of exponent. And for this particular state, the effective theory is like a QED3, like a U1 gauge field coupled to the massless fermions. The first two names kind of emphasizing this property that there is no free quasi-particle. The last two names kind of emphasizing this property that is described by U1 gauge theory coupled to the Dirac fermion.
Question, your opinion.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think this type of phase is can in principle be described with only bosonic fields?
I don't know. Yeah. So
I guess you could always have your fermion.
So this is version. This is a question. No, even worse.
Yeah, no.
You know, this is just effective theory which describe a field. I would say it's a pile of symbol we invented to describe the phase, but this pile may not be the right pile.
There is a related question, which was one of the questions I was going to ask, and since you're talking about this at the moment. Can we think of a reasonable local moment, a local model with local degrees of freedom, fermions, bosons? The question, which is really related to this, I mean, that's not necessary, probably, right? Okay, there's a related issue here. I mean, all phases we know of, they are the ground state in some limit or some reasonably local model with local degrees of freedom. I don't care if they are fermions, bosons, your grandmother. Okay, but local, okay? Now, I don't know of any reasonable model for which the U1 spin liquid with gapless fermions is actually the ground state of a local Hamiltonian. Okay. First of all, that's. But I'm not sure if that's okay.
Apparently,
SU4 case has a marginal chance in the sense that there is some numerics that is suggestive. Remember, this is a fairly small system still, okay? So we have to be... In other cases, phases usually we can identify in terms of reasonably local Hamiltonians, and it's usually not such a big deal to actually find the right phase. Maybe we don't have the right...
But this is more challenging, but large enough n, it's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if I am in n equals 2, then you don't know.
Then that's okay, a different issue.
No.
Make an actual derivation of the large n limit for some funny multi-spin ring thing.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, can you do that?
Make a large n.
Okay. Well, just
an actual construction.
Well,
as I should have said, it's a question of what would be the group.
The answer is no. I mean, I don't need a. I don't mean a rigorous proof. Even a vigorous proof will do here.
That was a question and it's related.
Exactly. It's a, this is a very good one. It's really the white stable, you know.
Nick Reed has asked what I think a very reasonable question at the bat. Is there an actual proof? And I do not want the proponents to avoid it by saying, what do you mean by a proof? I mean, I mean, give your proof, the one you mean as proof, okay?
I'll tell you what is known, right? And you can decide whether that it's proof enough or not, right? So what can be constructed is a model that at large n you can solve through a slave fermion mean field theory at n equals infinity. And the mean field ground state is has Fermi, four Fermi points. That's a stable mean field. That's the mean field ground state. It's global minimum. It's not just a nearest neighbor model. It involves ring exchange and so on. And then you do 1/n corrections, and then it's a gauge theory. And that gauge theory at large n is stable to against confinement. There are no relevant perturbations. It flows to a conformally invariant fixed point. It's controlled in the 1/n expansion of some particular model. Now, is that proof enough? Yeah, it's exactly the same proof you gave for Lord in the end.
I asked that as a some kind of a proof within mean field.
Yeah, okay, so that's what's known.
Yeah. So certainly this is assumed such a phase really exists as a stable phase. And so I didn't realize this is controversial. But there's a question is that why it's a stable? I think that will be very interesting. And for the signature breaking phase, when you have a gapless Goldstein mode, we know why it is stable. But here is much harder to argue. Maybe this project signature group have something to do with it, but this is a much harder question to answer. And come back to the question, do we really need a gauge theory here? And also the question whether...
Can we speculate on why it's stable? I mean, you asked that question. Maybe people in the audience have answers. Maybe they don't. I just want to...
No, the question is existing. That's what we are asking.
I assume it's stable here. So now the next question, why it's stable?
Within this large argument, as far as I can tell. Is it stable beyond that?
So the thing is whether there is a general understanding of a stability of this particular case, which the quasi-particle interact down to zero energy.
There might not be an answer to this question, right? It's possible that...
So I want to come back to the simpler example that I pointed out earlier, which is five-fold field theory at its critical point. Now there, you would say it's not stable, but maybe if you think in terms of RG language, you have a relevant operator at the critical point. Here you don't have a relevant operator. But in both cases, you're talking about fixed points in three dimensions. It's still described by a critical point at finite coupling.
How do you know there's a fixed point with only one relevant direction?
I mean, so it's really a question of classifying, understanding interesting fixed points of RG in three dimensions. And, and the five-fold field theory is a much simpler theory. And is there another free field description of that?
Yeah.
We don't know the answer to that. Probably not. But that may be a simpler question to address, and it's certainly a lot simpler than these questions you're posing here.
Yeah.
So this is a good point. These questions look easy, but they aren't. I mean, we don't know the answer you have to
fulfill. Yeah. No, I don't mean that. this is really that's really one way to look at it. It's really just all these are just a fixed point. So the stable really means stable phase really means there's no relevant perturbation, and stable critical point means there's only one relevant operator, things like that. And so that's one way to see. So to find a stable, so to find a stable phase, you just find all those theory with no relevant perturbation. So that's one way to put it. And you know, I don't know whether there's a more satisfying way to, you know, I kind of wish there was something like signature breaking, that way I understand the ghost on mode. That's to me, it's very satisfying. But this may relate to some question to address later. Okay, that's a one. Topological phase, depend on what you mean. If they have a gap, then there is a. But here I'm really talking about a gapless phase, which is a much harder question. You know, let me see whether I want to really be proactive.
Yeah.
But. Okay, the things, I feel this is important because. The existence of gapless excitation is kind of a very, very special thing. That is, so the interaction between those gapless excitation has to be very, very special so that they can interact and at the same time remain gapless. And so we hope there is some understanding of what's so special about those interactions. Why I say this is provocative, because you know, we live in a world whose electron mass is much less than Planck mass. So yeah, that's beyond this. So in a sense, if you understand that, you know, those are special theories which, you know, at the low energy somehow they have special interactions, and but those gapless excitations survive those interactions. And that may explain what we see, you know. Anyway, but for this particular case, yeah, I don't know whether we want to go on this. Whether some other people want to say.
Others may have comments also. We can come back to some of these comments.
Right, but you have some conjecture as to what other.
Not. I have some. Yeah, I thought about this, but you know, that's something kind of hanging in my mind. But you know, I feel this is maybe something to worry about, at least.
Can I ask a question? Do we know of any other interacting critical points or phases in 2+1 dimensions for which there's such an algebraic description? Does anyone know?
What do you mean by, I mean, how broad do you want to construe it?
Well,
I mean, you can make an SU2
probably
large enough.
Yeah, SU2, yeah, this QCD3 probably also works. I talked to David, he said, oh, that's a trivial. Enlarging limit. No, with gapless fermion, in the number fermion family go to infinity limit. You have a similar.
Many
fermions. Exactly, yeah.
Not another example, but
just
algebraic description of some critical theory.
Oh, algebraic description.
That's what you seem to want.
Yeah, No, none, yeah. Yeah, but I haven't got there yet.
So then, if you don't write down a Lagrangian or something, you just specify.
Like 2D conformal field theory.
Well, exactly.
You have to quantize it in some finite geometry to conformally relate to flat field. That would be the sphere, or is there any other domain geometry where you write down this sphere algebra of operators?
I don't know. But that's what you seem to say is desirable, right?
Let me
avoid writing down degrees of with this degree.
Yeah, because this there is no, but actually, you know, I feel there may be something to it, so that's what I'm not so sure. You know, whether you engage boson real or not, whether spin on real or not, whether they are real thing. But by something real here really have a maybe philosophical, even religious.
The question about whether the gauge theory is necessary or not,
has to be rephrased, I guess.
Yeah.
Whether the only observables that you can write are strictly local or they are non-local, like, you know, those loops that have topological meaning. And in that case, I have a doubt that you can do without the gauge theory description one way or other.
Yeah. The but this exists really does not really mean exists in the sense of what existence. It's really in some sense also means whether it's convenient, whether this is the right way to think about it, or whether this way to think about it would lead to some more deeper understanding. So I think more of that kind of meaning, you know.
Well, let me put it this way: without that way of understanding, it will still be essentially back to maximum.
Oh yeah.
But
So for this particular phase, you know, to say the gauge boson probably is real or more or less real because, you know, as Sensio pointed out, there's a conservation of flux. As a result, the flux output have integer scaling dimension and the correlation function just 1 over x squared. It's a very simple thing. X to the 4?
Yeah,
oh, yeah, x to the 4 probably. So scaling dimension 2, right? Okay. And but since there's no quasi particle pole, so there's some concern whether that really, you know, there's some concern. And so this really kind of may be controversial. That is you know, when we encounter this kind of phase in one dimension, we do not try to formulate as a gauge theory, although we can actually many one dimensional like a spin 1/2 Heisenberg chain can be formulated as a spin 1/2 fermion coupled to U1 gauge field. And after that, you get spin 1/2 Heisenberg chain, but we don't formulate that way. For spin 1/2 Heisenberg chain, we have this so-called SU2 Kasimuni algebra to describe it.
Actually, that's a good analogy
for
which I think is always misunderstood. There is a profound difference between these 1 plus 1 dimensional deconfining mechanisms, if you wish, or fractionalization mechanisms, and what we see in 2 plus 1 dimensions. See, in 1 plus 1 dimensions, it's always topological, it's always a kink type mechanism, and the gauge field is always ultra-confining. It's in the chiral sector that you see that.
Yes.
You never see the gauge, the color or degrees of freedom are never active, they are never visible.
Exactly.
Whereas in 2 plus 1 dimensions, you're really talking about seeing the fundamental charge, but it's a very different mechanism, and it's totally unrelated to what happens in 1D.
Yeah.
If you try to use the gauge theory language, you will conclude that the things will never be seen because they're always ultra-confined.
Yeah, that's completely right.
If we're looking for examples of algebraic description, maybe one, I'm not sure if it is, but you know, the high energy theorists do have these ADS-CFT theories where they actually know some non-trivial critical exponents exactly in three-dimensional relativistic
theories,
for instance.
That would be really nice.
Which
seems
like some step in that direction. Presumably, there's something algebraic.
Okay,
about it.
Yeah. So if you go along that direction, it looks like we don't need a gauge theory, but we need a gravity in one extra dimension.
We know for a fact that gravity is extremely important for understanding
fundamental mechanics. So one comment on this thing that Chad, you know, since you're interested in algebraic descriptions, one thing that we know from the field theoretic description is that, let's say we start with an SUN spin model in which this phase is realized, but low energies, we can ask what symmetries are there at the low energy fixed point, right? So this flux conservation is one symmetry that there's a conservation law that calculates the low energy fixed point.
Yeah.
But we know that there's more. The global SUN spin symmetry is actually enlarged to SU2N mod Zn.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't know if the I don't know if these two things are necessarily tied together or then.
Yeah, the conservation law will be really, really helpful, I think. I think in one dimension, this finding this emerging conserved current actually is crucial to find the algebraic description of the 1D. But my point here is that, you know, that really the Anderson's name, 2D Latin liquid, you know, Anderson tried to understand high TC in terms of 2D Lantian liquid. Although the comparison to 1D fails, but I think the idea, this desire to get rid of gauge theory, I think still have a valid point there. And for the, especially for high TC. And, but, so what's really missing is really that in higher dimension, from algebraic point of view, we only know to do two things, the boson commuting algebra or Fermi anti-commuting algebra. And if you look at the thing from this point, it looks like we really know very, very little, because all our theory are based on these two algebra. And imagine if somebody have a third or fourth or other soluble algebra, then the whole culture will be different, because then there's a we can build the theory based on those algebra. So that's a so this is really the desire, that whether if this phase indeed truly exists as stable phase, which may point to a direction that have very, very special interaction at low energy. And hopefully there are some kind of algebraic structures like boson or fermion algebra, which kind of capture this low energy physics. Then at that stage, we probably can get rid of gauge theory, at least for this case, you know. In many other cases, the gauge field is useful because they do correspond to quasi-particle, but in this case, it became tricky. Yeah, I think that's all I want to say. And yeah.
Okay, that was stimulating. We should...
announcement.
Oh, okay, thanks, Shankar. I guess I want to remind everyone one more time that for the speakers to please give copies of their talks. You can do that after leaving, even by upload them on the ITP website.
There's a website, it's very convenient.
Yeah. Okay, so...
I mean, it's free advertisement for your work. These sites are beautiful. They get thousands, maybe millions, you know, of hits. Hits are defined very liberally. Okay, very, very liberally, but still. The large end, right?
So the object is to get more hits than the string theory.
And our quantum hall almost achieved that. Almost. David was very impressed. He came and told me, this thing is getting as many hits as string theory. It's completely perfect.
All right. So everyone click as much as possible.
Yes. Click on, okay?
Yeah. Yes. Unleash your robots on their website. Okay, so it would be, I think I'd like to hopefully pick, yep.
Can I ask about that question?
You certainly can. Should have asked earlier.
Do you think the Heisenberg algebra is basic quantum
mechanics?
Or is it a convenient?
What is a Heisenberg algebra? Oh, you mean this XP commutation relation? Ah.
Not Heisenberg.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
What do you think he's asking? Go on. Tell
him. Yeah. Not quite. You know, yeah. Oh, okay, yeah. So in this context, you know, quantum mechanics is still the foundation. You know, we don't want to destroy quantum mechanics yet. And those algebra essentially, you know, the way I try to look at the boson commuting and the Fermi commuting algebra, not as a defining algebra to define the system on the lattice, but to view this as a emergent algebraic structure which govern the dynamics of a low-lying quasi-particle, kind of from that point of view. So from this point of view, it would be kind of strange to say why we only get boson commuting algebra and the Fermi anti-commuting algebra as a algebra governing the low-lying emergent quasi-particle. And certainly underlying everything, we have quantum mechanics, we have this Heisenberg algebra. And but the emergence of many body algebra would be different. But yeah, I now I see what you mean. Then you wonder if you know, if our universe has some many body states, the emergent quasi particles have very different algebra, they are probably the things quite different. Yeah.
Even the fermion is very strange, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's I don't know. Yeah, so those algebra, I try to view them as emergent rather than as a defining structure of quantum mechanics. But then would be interesting to see what's.
Well, it may be strange. If there were no fermions, we wouldn't be here.
Well, being there is strange.
Right now.
I mean, the preventive view is I think Chopin is also, which I like, but there's also in the five of these. Fermi, the boson should be basic and Fermi should be put out. I mean, they're sort of orthodox views of the opposite. Quarks is sort of Fermi, the boson. And then all these theories that based on supersymmetries, supersymmetries, they put Fermi to the boson. The boson seems to be, but maybe it's just in the mind, the boson.
I think given the time constraints, it would be let's try and keep the discussion moving. And I'd like to try and get contributions from the full spectrum here. So I'm going to try and swing the thing in the opposite direction now, and then we'll come back to some intermediate ground after that. So I asked Antoine to say a couple of things on the. We can see what the realistic view is of the exotic.
Meaning whether bosons or fermions are fundamental, Antoine has a view on that?
Well, I worked on magnetic monopoles in the past.
You did. But then it's for the light.
Do you want this thing? You don't want this thing.
Right? Which thing?
The projector?
No. Okay. I just wanted to try to get us back on the ground for a few minutes, if I can get hold of a piece of chalk. Okay, so I'm not going to try to be provocative, even though that's what Leon would like me to do, but I'm not going to do that. The only thing I'd like to do is maybe to point out that a few things that I think might need more attention or in connection with some concrete materials. Okay, so. One thing on which I have personally very little to say about, but I think is really worth more effort, is about orbital degrees of freedom. And, okay, so in my talk here, I sort of killed some realization of an orbital liquid for one concrete material, which was this family of titanates. But that was by no means intended to say that orbital liquids cannot exist in other materials. And I really don't have much to say on this subject, except to point out that in my view, there's been comparatively really little work on models which have both orbital and spin degrees of freedom as compared to purely spin models. And it's quite amazing to see how little we know on the Kugel-Chomsky model, which is this effective model of orbitals and spin interacting together, which have an SU4 symmetric point with interesting properties. And we really know very little about them, and I think this is a place to look for more interesting kind of phases. And there are some candidates for materials that may realize exotic phases of spin orbital liquids. There is an interesting paper, I think, that appeared early this year by Millar, Verne, and co-workers about, I think, lithium and IO2 that might be a candidate for such a phase. So that's just one thing I wanted to point out. The second thing I would like to sort of discuss a little bit is systems that have weird metallic behavior. And I'm not yet ready to qualify weird as being exotic. I'll try to make a distinction between those metals that I believe are weird, interesting, but still reasonably conventional.
Weird is less exotic than exotic.
Well, you decide on that. strange metals, whatever you want to call them. And those which may be actually really exotic. So, so there are a few materials that I would like to emphasize that would fall into this category. And the first class of those, and I think it's very important when we talk about strange metallic behavior to distinguish between two different situations. There is one situation in which we have definitely non-Fermi liquid-like resistivities, but these resistivities are very high. So the resistivity is a lot bigger than some Mott limit, which would correspond to a mean free path of order, the lattice spacing. So these are states in which KFL extracted in some naive manner would be smaller or sometimes even much smaller than one. So in a situation like that, it's completely clear that no quasi-particle description can apply. But in fact, it may just mean that we are above some coherence temperature for the quasi-particles and that we really need a description of transport which is completely different from conventional Boltzmann transport involving quasi-particles.
I don't understand this at all. What KFL has got to do with quasi-particles? You're making an assumption that AL is limited by electron-electron interaction?
No. I'm not making any assumption.
I don't understand this statement at all.
Okay, so what I'm saying is the following.
This is disorder. Quasi-particles perfectly well defined. The basis is different, that's all.
Okay, that is true. What I'm just saying is that you just look at the resistivity, okay?
And so you have to talk about
the temperature-dependent resistance.
Yes, I'm coming to that.
Yeah.
So what do you want to say, Sylvia?
Temperature dependence.
Yeah, temperature dependence. I'm coming to that, okay.
Each time
when one writes KFL on the board, I get complaints. So let me remove KFL.
Okay, good.
You accept rho bigger than rho mod? Do you like that? A little bit bigger, better?
That's a very strange material, but it doesn't mean no particles are defined. That's all I'm saying. It's strange, I
completely agree with that statement. Actually, what I'm going to say now is that there are several examples in which this happens above some coherence temperature, but good quasi-particles form at a lower temperature. And it is certainly not correct to say that sort of bad metals that have no resistivity saturation up to high temperature are necessarily exotic, non-Fermi liquid at low temperature.
Right,
that's the point I want to come to. Okay, so I think we agree on that. Okay, yes, but yeah, go ahead, Matthew.
Okay, so let's go above that decoherence.
Yes.
Temperature scale.
That's right.
And let me ask it another way. Is it possible to imagine tuning that decoherence scale to zero?
Yes, I'm coming to this. I mean, that's a very good question. And of course, that's one of the key questions in this story. Okay, so I just want to quote a few examples because there are many animals like that in nature, and they're not all the same. They're not all the same species, so they require some attention. We've seen, sorry?
Minerals, more likely.
Okay. So we've seen one yesterday, which is lithium V2O4, which is a very interesting mineral. Lithium V2O4, and there is a closely related thing, which I think are these sodium cobalt oxides that have attracted lots of attention recently, which are probably closely related. No, these are triangular layers, but they share some common features. One of the common features is geometric frustration. I'm coming to this. Geometric frustration for spin. So these guys are pile clause, these guys are triangular layers. So they both have geometric postulation. And also, they're probably close to charge ordering, both of them. Close to some charge ordering transition. And I think these two facts together lead to very interesting physics, which is only poorly understood at this stage. So let me say a few more things about lithium V204. We've seen some yesterday. So lithium V204 has a resistivity which, as a function of temperature, goes from some good, honest T-square behavior below about 50 Kelvin to something which becomes huge and, let's say, roughly quasi-linear and goes to the roof above that temperature scale. Simultaneously, as we go through that T star, the specific heat coefficient becomes very, very large, which means that there is a huge entropy stored at low temperature. And Hide emphasized, and I certainly take side with that point of view, that this is certainly due to the storage of entropy at low temperature has a lot to do with geometric frustration in this system. So it's completely reasonable to think that there are quasi-particles of the heavy fermion kind that form here below T star, that above T star, these quasi-particles are gone. They are no longer coherent quasi-particles, but the spin degrees of freedom still bind together into some form of spin liquid state. And indeed, the NMR experiments, if I remember correctly, for these materials do support that view, because below this T star we have something which is more or less Coringa-like, and above T star we have some saturation, which would roughly correspond to chi double prime of omega being a constant, which points at interesting spin liquid dynamics. So above this T star we have an interesting state in which the charge and spin have somehow unbinded. The charge is completely incoherent, the resistivity is very large, but there is still some very interesting spin dynamics. And the high resistivity is presumably due to the scattering of which can be very local scattering of the charge degrees of freedom onto the spin modes.
When you say the charge is incoherent, you mean really the electron is incoherent?
Sure, the electron is incoherent.
Yeah. There may be some hidden coherence in the charge sector.
There may be, but this is a very huge resistivity, though. That's right. So I'm going to contrast that to other systems in which the resistivity is non-Fermi liquid-like, but small, right? So these guys would really be more exotic in the sense that the electrons are incoherent in such materials, but there is some very efficient charge transport mechanism, which is not the case here.
Yeah, although it doesn't necessarily mean that there isn't coherence. I think that.
I agree. I agree with that, but. I agree with that, but let's put it that way. There is no obvious evidence that this should be the case in such materials.
Now, there are examples where pretty much what you say there happens. I mean, take a sliding dielectric liquid, which is a very anisotropic system, weak tunneling between lines, between one-dimensional systems.
What I'm saying here, you mean?
We go to very high, no, like the question that you started with.
Which one?
Go to very high temperatures and the system becomes quasi one.
This one.
And therefore incoherent along the direction perpendicular to the layers or the lines, if you wish. And
yes.
At low temperatures eventually becomes
Fermi. Yes, yes.
This incoherent temperature.
Yes, I agree. I'm trying to contrast. See, I'm going to come to these guys, which are very anisotropic. I'm coming to this.
Yeah,
okay.
Yes. I just want to make sure, this high resistivity have nothing to do with impurity. It's supposed to be probably clean.
I think Hide can probably answer that, but I think the answer is no.
No, probably phonons. Can't be good.
No, that's not phonons.
It's not phonons, no? I mean, how is it known? What's the basis of the statement? I mean, I was asking. I don't know anything about these materials. I see linear T
I say it's phono. That's what I say.
That's,
okay. Now, what is the evidence against that is what I would like to know. Just because they don't like phono? It's wishful thinking. If we think exotic is going to happen because we happen to love exotic and we happen not to like non-exotic.
No, but I'm not saying...
It's a good question.
Shankar.
Maybe you take it.
Yeah.
I think it's your point.
I think these are phonons. You should talk to a band structure person, Phil Allen or somebody, who can actually calculate the band structure very carefully. And I'll bet within a factor of two registers, it will come up to be this.
Suppose we take one of the other materials, like zinc chromate, which did not have this charge ordering instability, but structurally very similar. The resistivity and so is very different.
Yeah, but the phonons could be very, very different because of charge ordering.
But charge, that's fine. That's what you call phonons.
That's your view.
I mean, there are no phonons from the government system.
There are a number of systems which are strong electron phonon coupling. For example, A15 compound, which is a famous superconductor. In this case, you see beautiful relative saturation around 100 micrometer centimeter, right? And that's phonon system. But when we have a system pretty close to motor insulating state or charge over state, and the system always shows this peculiar behavior. And if we take a look at optical spectrum, we don't see any well-defined Drude. And there is something strange happening on electron volt scale, so that cannot be phonon.
Okay, good. Yes. Has anybody done a calculation of resistivity from a band structure, first principles, or semi-first principles using electron phonon? I mean, what you're saying, I understand, but has anybody done that and found that electron phonon contribution is much, much less than what you measured? That's the question I'm asking.
Yeah, there's an attempt to do that. For example, who are they? German.
Well, there are calculations of resistivity involving electron phonon scattering, but not in this material. Not that I know of in this material.
No, I'm saying that's the minimal, but, I would say, is needed. Before it's needed, it cannot be formed.
Shankar, you think that the linear resistivity in the high PCs can be
scattered? Well, what I think is not so important as saying that nobody has seriously tried to. There are serious people who think that.
No, but Shankar, you cannot. Okay.
No. I mean, this is. Now you're answering a question. I mean, that's a totally different topic. Okay, we are discussing this material. Let's stick to this.
Well, that's why I think it's important to try to push these in practice, to push decoherence or coherence scales down.
Sure.
And if it's down,
that's another issue.
You'll drop phone off.
Right. Actually, Matthew, I'm going to come to this. But. Phonon is a possibility. I don't think it's realized in this case. But what I'm trying to say is that situations like that are not that strange. And actually, we have in our hands some theories of electron-electron scattering that can do that job, including dynamical mean field that I'm not going to talk about right now. Okay? But I think having this regime. I'm not so sure in terms that if you blame this on electron-electron scattering, there are many other theories that can reproduce such behavior.
But for electron-electron scattering, you will need serious Oum clamp.
Sure.
Of course. This is not a trivial endeavor. I mean, you really need to do the thing right.
The resistivity, since we are talking about theories, in DMFT, the resistivity is entirely dominated by Oum clamp.
DMFT
so,
is But
right. Okay, so now what we learned yesterday in Hide's talk is that indeed this lithium V2O4 system might well be close to a charge ordering transition that can be stabilized by applying pressure. And so that raises the possibility of driving T star to zero, as Matthew would like to have it, and having some heavy fermion Fermi liquid state. So actually, one can indeed explain the very large effective mass of this material from geometric frustration idea and have here a crossover between a regime with a large Fermi surface and a small Fermi surface, which is something I worked on and Subir and Sentil worked on. Once you go above T star and have this spin liquid like behavior, you can perhaps realize a sort of a small Fermi surface Condo lattice type of system. But,
on the y-axis?
Sorry?
Temperature.
Right. And that would be pressure or anything that can drive T star to small value.
And why do they have to connect to the same thing?
Sorry, what?
Why is the dotted line that's in touch with a judge limit?
Okay, I mean, that's a question. I don't think anybody knows that.
The models that you and I worked on didn't have any chart.
No, no, sure.
Spin.
That's right.
Well, I
agree, but what's going on in this material is both things,
okay.
Right? I'm just trying to say what happens. Somehow we sort of learn from Hidei that these materials that tend to charge order are also very good at maintaining spin frustration without ordering on the side where they are not charge ordered. So maybe there is some interplay of charge and spin, which is interesting for in that respect. Okay, so let me just move on because I'm taking too much time. So now I would like to contrast this sort of thing for which I claim there are various theories around that can do a reasonable job on these materials to more interesting or to more exotic situations, and in particular to very anisotropic metals. And that connects to what Eduardo was saying, which are basically metallic in some direction. And insulating or confining for the charge in some other direction. And there is a long list of those. There are, of course, cuprates. But not only cuprates, there are also, again, the sodium cobalt oxides, the rutenates, and also the Bechgard salts. So these would typically be systems in which the resistivity, so for example, in the rutenates, we have a situation in which the resistivity along the AB plane is doing something like this, while the resistivity along the C-axis is doing something like that. And there is a characteristic temperature above which basically the system is confined in the planes and there is no transport perpendicular to the layers. Again, when looking at such a situation, it's very important to ask whether in that regime the metallic resistivity is big or small as compared to the Mott limit. If it's big as compared to the Mott limit, then you can analyze, at least as a first explanation for this, you can propose that actually, again, quasi-particles are gone. But still, you have to explain that the system remains metallic in the plane while being insulating in the transverse direction. So I can only see two possible explanations for that, and I will stop on this. One, again, is a less exotic explanation, which is that for some reason, there are some hot and cold spots, regions, let's say, on the Fermi surface. Or perhaps, in the case of rutenates, hot and cold sheets of the Fermi surface. And that for some stupid material-dependent reason, the current matrix element transverse to the plane happens to be small at the cold spots. So this is an explanation that was proposed by Yoffe and Millis for the cuprates, and which also probably applies to the rutenates. And actually, I would like to direct or to draw your attention to very nice experiments recently by Vala, Ding, et al., who connected transport measurements in the rutenates with photoemission experiments. And they could demonstrate that this crossover temperature, which is seen in transport, is also the one at which coherent quasiparticles disappear from the photoemission signal along certain points of the Fermi surface. Now, of course, the more exotic situation is where...
So what about the question of what causes the hot points to begin with?
Okay, so actually, in the case of ruttenates, there are several sheets of the Fermi surface. There are sheets that correspond to very, very good hybridization within the planes and that have a large bandwidth, and sheets in which the hybridization is mainly along C-axis and, in which the bandwidth is very narrow, is quasi-1D-like, and have very small bandwidth. So in a situation like that, you could quite naturally, because these bandwidths are so different, think that the coherence temperature for the 2D-like sheet is going to be much bigger than the coherence temperature for these two other sheets of the Fermi surface. And it happens that the C-axis transport is associated with the sheets that have the smallest coherence temperature. So you don't need to invoke the complete breaking of quasiparticles to explain that phenomenon. However, in Bechgard salts or in the cuprates, we are in a situation where above T star, this resistivity, at least at optimal doping, is still small. And in Bechgard salts, above this sort of deep confinement temperature, the resistivity along the chains is still pretty small. And so I think this is reasonable evidence that there is really a breaking of the quasiparticle concept and that some other objects efficiently transport charge in the chains. So in the Bechgard salt, I think that this observation is a reasonable evidence that there is some unconventional, perhaps Luttinger liquid state in the chains.
I will give a counter example of this last thing.
Okay.
I don't need that.
So I'm going to talk about a material where transport has been very extensively studied. It's a material that Jay Hansen spoke about yesterday. Two-dimensional electronic gallium arsenide layer. He had KFL could be
okay.
This is for all densities of the bit. This is a generic behavior of gallium arsenide heterostructures. Okay, those temperatures, T star, and how far this goes depends on the densities. Okay, and the KFL depends on that. This is generic behavior. What I'm talking about. Okay, KFL could be as large as 1,000 here, in which case the mean free path is like 100 microns, or KFL could be as small as 5. That depends on density, what it is. Over here, I do not remember what the KFL would be. I think it could be of the order of 1. And this is absolutely quantity to be understood by including all the phonons and everything. And, by just generalizing Athon's argument, this would be a Luttinger liquid. I mean, this is quantity will be understood. There is no hand waving in it.
No,
this is very low temperature.
I've been very careful at trying to distinguish. So in the Bell gap solve,
right,
you have to combine various observations.
The first one is that you have a very anisotropic behavior of the resistivity.
Right.
Okay. The C-axis resistivity above 100 Kelvin, T star is about 100 Kelvin for the Bellegarde salts, is insulating-like.
Right.
So that's a very important point to keep in mind.
No, I understand that, but I thought the main point you made was that fairly low, this T star is fairly low. Here, T star is only 1 Kelvin.
No, no. I mean, the second thing to keep in mind, is that above T star, in the Bellegarde salt, the resistivity is still good along the chains. So this resistivity.
So what you're doing is contrasting this versus this, is what you're saying, right?
Right.
So
I'm contrasting this.
So your argument was not just T star is small.
No,
it's a little bit
not at all. Okay. Not at all.
I thought that you meant T star.
I was not clear.
But in any case, here the T star is of the order of 1 Kelvin. It goes, you know, less than 1 Kelvin. And it goes up over a range of 100. Only point I'm trying to make, look, this is completely understood, so I'm not going to belabor this point. This argument that resistivity is linear over a large temperature range, so something exotic is going on, is completely false.
But Shankar,
that by itself, I'm saying. That by itself. Okay?
My point is exactly the same as yours. So, okay. What I'm trying to say is that a resistivity which is metallic-like, but very large, okay, and with no saturation and so on, is not so strange in itself.
Good, so we agree.
For example, in the BDT organics, this is observed.
No, I get your point. I misunderstood something. I thought you were emphasizing how low T-star is. No. What you're emphasizing is the contrast between insulating
and
transparent.
And the fact that this guy is good metallic.
Okay, I just finished by saying what the behavior here looks like. Behavior there, this of course is this physics, so-called 2D MIT physics. Behavior here looks like this. If I expand that, that looks like, that's actually very interesting. It looks like it goes up, comes down, and then goes up again. And the reason is that you have many things now interfering, you know, you have impurity scattering, phonon scattering, various things coming in, so competing mechanisms, okay? When you have competing mechanisms, various things could happen. And this is, you know, this is quantitative not understood, but it's a small effect. This effect is of the order of, you know, 5% or so. And this effect, of course, is factors of, you know, 100. I mean, one has to be careful if you do not know the quantitative mechanism, is the only point I'm making here.
Sure.
Oh, no, I'm not comparing. I'm just.
You can have all this small k, right? Because they're going to go small, right? You have all this small k, right? That's why you get.
Yes, this is
the last. Sure, absolutely. Shankar, you'll have more opportunity to speak later.
But not about this point. Not about this point.
Yeah.
If I understood what you're saying, that when it's 5 down there, it's 1 at the high range was what you were guessing, right?
That was my guess. That part.
Okay. But if, so in other words, if KFL was a tenth, which is really where Antoine was headed.
Jim, what if we figured a very high range? I know. No. The question is, if we take a rather crummy gallium arsenide system and go to 300 Kelvin, what if you get the KFL? That could be less than, much less than 1.
Never done anything.
But let me. Let me say one more thing. Which is the original, I don't know if it was the original, but the good bad metal argument of Emery and Kivelson that I remember went as follows. They said if you see something linear, and nothing happens when KFL crosses 1, and you get to much smaller than KFL equals 1, and nothing has happened on the curve. That's suggestive that the mechanism, that was the original argument, right? What they argued was that you didn't see a coherence temperature of any kind or any indication that you had gone into a different regime. Then you wanted to attribute the transfer. So here, presumably, you would see something happening as you get to...
It's a good question. You can look at the numbers afterwards. You have to look at the experimental papers and
I think we have some other experimentally somewhat related comments.
There's a couple of comments, I guess. Can I just speak from here?
Don't come up, so you're
okay.
Already.
As for me, raise some questions, don't make comments as such. The I guess Santolan pointed out certainly lots of mysterious phenomena and experiments on various correlated electron systems. From a theoretical point of view, as we've seen in this conference, there's certainly been lots of theoretical progress on interesting quantum phases, which have properties that would be considered exotic by the vast majority of solid-state physicists. So the question for those of us who work on this sort of exotic quantum phases is, what can we do to judge the relevance of these ideas to either existing materials and existing experiments, or to experiments that can be done reasonably short term? So that's basically a question that I'd like to raise for discussion. Any comments, ideas, thoughts?
Tough question.
Yeah.
So how long is the short term? 10 years?
Measure transport and look for linearity.
No, okay. Okay, so let me make the statement. Let me make my question a bit more focused, right? One could of course say, you know, one should directly try to calculate transport or, you know, 1/T1 or something, and then try to compare with sort of the mysterious phenomena that we see. But you know, a more sharper characterization of these exotic quantum phases that people talk about. Like, for instance, my favorite example is actually the following. We've known of ferromagnets for centuries, right? And the reason is that we could do fairly macroscopic experiments with them and detect the ferromagnetic order. But presumably, in magnetism itself, antiferromagnetism is much more common than ferromagnetism. But we didn't know of antiferromagnets till about 70, 80 years ago. And part of the reason is that we didn't have the right probes to look for antiferromagnetism, right? With the development of techniques like neutron scattering and so on, we knew how to look for antiferromagnetism, and we quickly discovered lots and lots of antiferromagnets. So the analogous question for these exotic phases that many people talk about is, what's the analogous probe? What are the kinds of experiments that we should be suggesting to directly look for the exotic order that exists in these phases? Okay. So,
this question was raised by Donald Rumsfeld, the question of the unknown unknown.
Maybe in that one we should move on.
Yeah. Any responses to that?
No, it's not. It's really, I think Sanji really raised a very important question. But my question is whether experimentalists really need a theorist to do anything. I mean, what I try to say is that if you see the things that I wonder if such material exists and you see it, you know it's exotic. You know, that's
the obvious.
Yeah, I don't know, but I always think about this. You know, how you know, kind of dream. You know, how first exotic material was defined, but that perhaps maybe they find a phase transition line which cannot attribute any moment or something. But I don't know. But that's another kind of. I mean, if you just see it, you know, it's exotic, or whether entire funding from experimentalists, whether one really need some real smoking gun to see this. Yeah.
Well, I guess I'd just like to give one example which has been rather influential in the frustrated magnetism experimental situation, which is that in spin ice, you know, frustrated magnetisms go along with large degeneracies, and that shows up as entropy at low temperatures. So in spin ice, someone's actually measured spin ice a long, long time ago and noticed that they couldn't retrieve all the entropy at low temperatures. So they said, well, perhaps we have to look more carefully, and never did. And then the smoking gun experiment took place 30 years later when someone with the theory of spin ice in hand noted that this was missing. So, I mean, it's totally obvious. Only if you have an idea of what to look for,
okay,
you're going to find it. But at the same time, the things that we have is the actual experimental data. So I think if we're looking for exotic behavior, then we have to look at lithium vanadate and things like that, and not as a not for a probe which couples directly to topological order. I mean, so, I mean, it's not a very profound statement, but I just think that in this field there's so many phenomena which we absolutely do not understand, and very likely a lot of things are lurking there which we just have to get our hands dirty and actually look at the experiments.
The other possibility is Senthil could propose a third experiment which involves inserting an actual graduate student into a micron.
Thanks. Okay, why don't we move on to another speaker. I think, Duncan, did you have, yeah? It looks like maybe too many transparencies.
Okay. Okay. Well, time to go then. Okay. I guess one of the things that seems that struck me as in the emerging issues from a number of point of views. There's a pointer, right? Was that these beautiful d-isotopy and stuff like this, so these different ways of looking at string theories for condensed matter seems very a key thing we need for some of these transitions. And this, what seems to be missing is to do the chiral case carefully and reevaluate some of the issues in quantum Hall transitions. I always used to think that a transition between two quantum Hall states, say at the same filling factor, would be a question of a first order transition with a domain wall sweeping across the system. And an interesting example from the atomic context, people have been interested in the Feshbach resonance, where you have a term that binds a pair of, in that case, spin half fermionic atoms together and into making a molecule. And now this goes beyond the kind of electronic models, because the molecule lives in its own Hilbert space. It's not, so basically you remove a pair of electrons from the system and convert them into the molecule. Well, that's done in the context of rotating traps, but it's just as good as in a quantum Hall context, where the molecules are charged two bosons. And then the interesting case which we've been looking at with Edrizai was the issue of just the transition between the nu equals 2 state, the filled Fermi system for spin up and spin down free particles, free electrons, going over to the nu equals a half state of charged 2 bosons, the Laughlin state. And in fact, one can easily kind of rewrite the... so I should just show you. One can write the two wave functions for the Laughlin state. I just focus on this is a kind of fancy way to write the van der Mond determinant for up and down spin particles. Yeah, U and V means up and down spins, and if you want to, you can rewrite. We can rewrite just the Slater determinant states for up and down spins in this fashion, but we can also remanipulate them into an explicitly spin singlet form that looks like the Laughlin state. And there you see these factors. Now we have a spin factor and a charge factor, and the Laughlin this is now like a Laughlin state of the center of mass of pairs. And the only difference is we lose the spin degrees of freedom in going when we kind of glue the particles together and form bosons. So you have a nice, the charge parts of the wave function remain essentially unaffected by the surgery that removes the spin degrees of freedom. And you see that in these kind of pictures where spin half fermions would have two edge states, one for charge and one for spin, because it's nu equals 2, so it's got, and you can organize those into SU2 for spin and actually SU2 for charge too. There's a pseudo spin symmetry. And the Laughlin state just has an algebra at the edge, which is also just the SU2 level 1 for charge, and it's missed the two things. So going between these two, you basically have to shrink the spin edge state, and it will disappear. Well, this is the first order transition. You have some energy that wants to maximize the area of the red area and minimize it on the other side, and the thing will just contract. But if we and we can
magnetic field, there's no transition between these limits, right?
We're talking about quantum Hall states.
Yeah, so this is different from zero magnetic field.
Of course, yeah.
Is just an edge transition or a bulk transition?
Well, I'm just raising the possibility of bulk transitions. Oh, okay. One would have, up to now, one's really thought in terms of these things being first order transitions where the edge state just shrivels up and will disappear, right? I'm discussing whether they're first or second order transitions, right? This is a picture of the first order transition, but the second order transition essentially would occur when, because the transition occurs when the area law, which between the shaded and unshaded areas disappears, and then the question is whether the line tension of the string is positive, which is first order, or negative, which is where the string would want to kind of expand to fill space, the edges. And so the thing that gives one some and of course then this actually gives you a nice picture of confinement and deconfinement, because in these two cases a charged excitation, a hole could be viewed as a little hole having a string of being surrounded by a charged string and a spin string, and as you go through the Feshbach resonance, the spin region kind of can spread out, and one sees that by tuning the virtual fluctuations between a pair of electrons and a molecule allow the spin to gradually delocalize. So in the other state, we would of course have the Laughlin state of the molecules, where you have semion holes which would carry half a molecule, which is charge E, but the spin-on is made by dumping an atom or an electron into the hole, which neutralizes its charge and gives it spin. So we have the two natural excitations are the fermions, which are in some sense can be viewed as the two strings glued together, and when this little bag of, each bag has a defect on it containing the charge or the spin, and basically when this bag turns inside out, it liberates you have the picture of the confinement, deconfinement in a very kind of string-like picture. And now these are strings which have primary fields or twists or defects, spin-ons or hole-ons stuck on them. So of course one would think a string would maintain a positive tension, and this would be a first-order transition that where this unraveling or lake to island picture occurred. But one of the early kind of interesting states, which was paired states, which is exact solution of some Hamiltonian, which we pointed out was the so-called Hall-Lehmann-Mizzi state, which was a spin singlet attempt to come up with a state to explain the nu equals 5/2 results, because initially the tilted field dependence suggested they were spin singlet. And actually this wasn't written in a Pfaffian form, but it can be written in a Pfaffian form. It wasn't originally, and it was in fact, I believe, the Reed-Moore state was, I believe, the attempt to make a spin triplet version of this state, and that appears to be the correct 5/2 state. But this state was a very interesting state in the sense it was, for a long time, studying its count of zero modes at the edges and things, and its zero energy states of a particular Hamiltonian, of which is exact on the torus, was always very enigmatic, because it couldn't be fitted to quantum field theory. To conformal field theory. So it seemed to be a counterexample to the idea that quantum Hall state edges must always be unitary conformal field theories. And this was resolved actually by Nick Reed and his student Dimitri Green, who noticed you could really reinterpret all these interesting properties in terms of this thing being a critical state. So this thing could never be fitted, this theory could never be fitted to conformal field theory, because it has, of course, partly a conformal field theory, the edge modes of a quantum Hall state, but it turns out to have a gapless excitation throughout the interior. So in some sense, while Nick successfully disposed of this state as a candidate for a regular quantum Hall state, it actually turns it into something possibly even more interesting, an explicit example of a two-dimensional critical theory. Now, apparently the analysis of this would suggest that this has actually gapless, gapless neutral fermionic or neutral excitations with a k-squared law, so it would be a z equals 2 kind of behavior. Just this apparent example of an explicit model with an explicitly at a critical point for these things seems to be very motivating to suggest there could be a general theory of second order transitions where strings condense in this way because their string tension goes negative due to quantum fluctuations or something. So that actually seems to be, so actually the chiral theories, which seems in one sense simpler, another sense more complicated than these non-chiral doubled Chern-Simons things that are being looked at, really seem to be an important thing to look at. And
is there any actual explicit connection of the, I mean, one understands what that critical theory is, right? Just some free fermion.
Well, the real thing, if you look at the ground states on the torus of the thing, you find it's got fivefold, or when it's even charge and a zero and a spin half zero mode when it's odd. And if you put these together, basically you see this, that it's the critical point between the weak and strong coupling paired states that right. Nick described, and Nick has come up with a count he believes it's a transition between a C equals 3 theory and a C equals 1 theory, and there's two sets of fermions.
Is there a way to connect that picture to something of loops?
Well, I would say that if it's a second order transition, basically it's a thing where a set of chiral edge modes, there's more chiral edge modes in one theory than the other theory, therefore what is happening at a critical point is has to be
explicit.
It's not a worked out, it's not a very explicitly dealt with theory, but it's very suggestive that this provides an example of what may be a nice picture which should be describable as a chiral string theory transition. And then if one asks, if one looks at this thing and tries to do some interpretation of the things that Sentil and Fisher and Vishwanath have been looking at, again in these, if you look at the kind of domain wall pictures one would get in drawing kind of dimer states and transitions from Neel to dimers, again one would see that the transition between a columnar dimer state and a Neel state, in the absence of square symmetry at least, which is the case that has been treated here, would again involve a string. Now we have a non-chiral string. The domain walls contain within themselves low-lying spin degrees of freedom, so they're not the kind of simple neutral domain walls that you would get in an Ising model, but they have internal degrees of freedom. In this case, it would be a double Chern-Simon theory would be related to the domain wall. So these simple domain walls are the places where the spin excitations in the dimer phase can be made. They would be tied, they of course will come in pairs tied to these domain walls, but again, if this can be a second order transition, or one can tune between first and second order transitions, one should be able to develop a picture in terms of a parameter that determines the line tension of such strings going negative. And I guess the Sentil Vishwanath example, the thing is now special to the square symmetry where these domain walls have go into Z4 clock models, and which are somewhat different because apparently the Z4, yeah. Well, there has to be at least one, there must be one general parameter in first or second order transitions, which is essentially the line tension of the domain wall defect. And so the generative one expects a first to tricritical to second order transition, presumably corresponding to a single parameter, which is either a positive line tension, a zero line tension, or a negative line tension in going from first to second order and the kind of tricritical. Yeah. So I understand that there's something special about the Z4 case because the, you know, the relevant operators are much less relevant, or much more. They're only dangerously irrelevant or something. But but again, these ones, maybe they're not. But anyway, this, but again, one would see if one starts to draw pictures like this, one sees, one at least has pictures of interesting domain walls which have internal theories defined on them, which is very reminiscent of the way one has a string theory picture. And in fact, looking at this, the domain wall would be the beta squared equals 8 pi sine Gordon model for this this case, for which the spin half excitations, I believe, are still known to be massive semions. So I guess the issue is whether in fact the identification of the spinons of the Z4 case as fermions is particular to what? Okay, I thought the story was it was a fermions, okay. Oh, well, my story would be they're probably semions, but looking at this general scheme of things, because the sine Gordon model, which would describe such a wall, clearly has semions as its massive spin half fermions. But anyway, the general message is I think that string theory pictures look very promising for some of these interesting transitions, and then one should be looking for string tensions going negative for second order transitions.
Kind of. If we're speculating, I think probably the your Z2 case is always first order.
I think it's interesting to think about things like this in terms of pictures.
It's interesting to think of things like this in terms of pictures of strings, which become surfaces in space-time. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, I think interacting string theory is pretty much intractable. And what you look for always is a field theory description. So you really want to work on the field theory, and then when you've understood the field theory, maybe you can interpret it in terms of strings.
Well, I find this nice, beautiful algebras that Michael Friedman was showing, and for this d-isotopy and all this kind of surgery operations, look like it. Conceivably, this could lead to some kind of better progress in actually working with strings rather than. But yeah, one needs a way to. Yeah.
Matthew, did you have?
Well, yeah, I may also make some sociological.
You have more dangerous.
Well, no, some incentive also to brought some of these things up. No, I mean, it's really a question of what we can do to. To bring this exotica into the mainstream physics community. And I think that's.
He's going to name names.
I'm not. So, I mean, I think, for theorists, this is pretty, it's actually kind of a challenging time in our field. And I think, those of us that would love to see exotica, I think there's going to be two things we're going to have to do. One is to really try to push our models to be more realistic, I think. It seems to me we have a pretty good handle on being able to write down models which, toy models which are designed and engineered to go into, arbitrarily complicated exotic phase. At least we're getting very good at doing that. But I think we're going to have to start trying to morph those towards models which are more realistic, motivated by, the types of experiments which are improving, every year on these powerful crystals and so forth, where the Hamiltonians are becoming, the Hamiltonians that are presumably describing systems are becoming pretty well characterized, actually. So we kind of know what type of models we're shooting towards, I think. I feel we should be trying to, some of us should be trying to push in that direction. I think the other thing, though, is really experimental signatures. And we're in desperate need of some better experimental signatures. And I think in this regard, unfortunately, conventional ordering can often be misleading and can throw attention onto things which perhaps are peripheral to the essence of the real physics, which is going on in some of these strongly correlated systems. Of course, conventional ordering is easy to see. There's an order parameter, you look locally, there it is. I mean, I know in Sentel's example with neutron scattering, needed for an antiferromagnet, but at least it is a local order parameter. So what we have is, you know, to look at these exotic phases, we have something which is much, much more complicated. And really, I mean, the problem is we're really trying to understand, you know, subtle phase correlations in the wave function of the electrons. And so I think, you know, my feeling is we're going to need more phase-sensitive probes. I'm speaking loosely because I'm not quite sure, you know, how to make this more concrete. But thinking in terms of, you know, Sentel's recent ideas on, you know, types of experiments, those are phase-sensitive experiments, which are ultimately, you know, measuring magnetic field and circulating currents, right? And so somehow, I think that's going to be really necessary, you know, in order us to sort of nail down, you know, whether or not some of these phases actually exist. One other thing which I think would be useful, actually, I mean, with experiments that are trying to do this, but I think sometimes the best signatures for these exotic phases can be revealed, particularly in the insulated cases when we you can sort of liberate the, if you have strange statistics, bosonic charge-ons or hold-ons, something like that, they can condense once they can, you know, liberate it, can move around. And so, you know, certainly being able to change doping is something which is going to be very important. I think for trying to disentangle the physics of these phases, it's open to discussion. I don't
want to stand up here. Matthew, then one should be thrilled about cold atom systems because measuring the wave function and the phase relationships in the wave function is precisely the sort of thing that these people can do, which is so difficult to do in kind of matter physics.
Oh, really? When they destroy everything?
Well, that's what they do these days, but it's not clear that they have to do this precise measurements all their lives.
Density correlations so they could measure phases
for
the
abundance. Yeah,
exactly. When they can have interfering systems.
I think once we get.
I don't think we've seen the end of this.
No, but I guess. We've got now, you know, sub-angstrom resolution of charge measurement. You get sub-angstrom resolution on spin or magnetic field, I think we'd go a long way.
Yeah.
Wait, say that again?
Well, the STM can now, you know, measure charge on the sub-angstrom scale, but we can't measure spin or magnetic fields on that scale. That would really help.
Because magnetic fields, orbital currents,
and that. Right. We are getting there, but there's still probably problems.
Yeah, but it's, you know, maybe not like
that. But it's a surface problem.
Yeah, well, it's,
No, but the thing about cold atoms, I mean, you know, as a solid state physicist, you know, I like exotica, but I would like to understand these correlated electron systems, and the hope is that the exotica is there. I mean, cold atoms is kind of a, you know, parallel development, which, you know, is extremely interesting, but it's not a substitute for the real thing.
I agree with you. I completely agree with that.
Well, nano Kelvin is uncomfortable. Room temperature is kind of good.
Okay. So the two issues here. The first one is showing the wider community that this topological order is absolutely crucial. I mean, and probably I would have thought the key step is to come up with some sort of variational wave function that you can then show. We do exactly what Laughlin did, basically, show in that context. Find a variational wave function, which is the best possible.
Those exist. We really have that now.
Laughlin has the
advantage.
You have one, but can you show for? Do you have one for some of these frustrated spin models that you can show?
Have been for years and it's
Okay, then on the second issue of experimental probes, if we go to the fractional quantum Hall effect and Postulus Thouless, there are two cases where topological order is well known and accepted. I mean, so why do we believe there's topological, there's no direct probe of topological order in either of them, is there?
Well, in the Postulus Thouless case, it's different.
Okay.
There simply means that you have topological expectations of time.
That's a much better phase of the two-dimensional XY model with no order parameter.
And it's critical. It's critical.
We believe it because there are a lot of direct predictions.
Right.
Initially,
right.
Historically, apparently, it wasn't believed.
So the key thing there is picking the power law. Correlations, is that?
Power law transport all the theory of the critical point, we scan predictions.
Look, also the fact that the
lyric issue is how we see the question.
Sure.
That's the real, that's the given. One can see material where the effect is the same.
But in connection to Ross' first question, the variational wave functions are there, the question is where are the Hamiltonians?
Yeah. Well, and they're very specialized at this point, those variation wave functions. It might be, probably is very useful to generalize them to make them more applicable to more physically relevant.
But there is no case, in the physics, at least went to the point of my question, there is no known reasonably local function for which the variation wave function really the expectation of this order. That's the way to prove. For the GAP case, we know how to do that. But for the GAP case, there is no local Hamiltonian that they know of for which we can do that.
You know, it depends on the pirate floor.
There are, of course, some special things like Luxon-Kittleson.
Yeah, but those have to close the GAP.
Not in for one.
Well, okay. Those are special.
That can make you feel better.
That's special.
That's better. But that might be what you get, is that if you look for Hamiltonians of an isomorphal and simple projection operator Hamiltonians at a critical point that you can solve exactly, then the critical points may turn out not to be the genetic critical points.
The point is, what you get if you try to find the answers to those questions. The ground state, not the
real difficulty is that for a typical critical system, it's way harder to write the ground state wave function because you've got a non-trivial critical state. If you've got a ground state wave function you can actually write down, chances are something non-genetic about the critical
function. 10 years ago, or even 5 years ago, one could criticize the field as a theorist to say, you know, we don't have models that do this. You know, I don't even believe it can happen, even in principle. That's just not tenable anymore. These things can happen in principle, and simple models are now, you know, writing down and solving. And, you know, anyone but the most, you know, hard-minded skeptic would say, sure, you know, it can happen in principle, and now the next thing is, can it happen in practice? And is it actually happening out there? And for that, you know, we've become more realistic and more experimental.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fractionalized quasi particles, so the low energy spectrum is made up, for instance, Raju's experiment is one in which you look and you see, right? So I think the issue is sort of as follows, which is if you look in the cuprates and you say, well, I don't see obvious signatures to the U1 spin liquid, it's because something else is intervening. But this, of course, is hard because now it's an unstable phase that you're trying to deduce, which is hidden. So that's going to be hard. Okay, so maybe there one needs something really clever. But if you were to find a U1 phase at low temperatures, I think you'd have no trouble finding it and just scattering. Because, you know, you would have a theory of the low temperature excitation, then you would calculate a structure factor and you would measure it. It would be different from what it would be for Sussman wave theory.
So it's
a question of what the realization is. A quantum critical point which is covered up by something, or a phase which is unstable to some, but the low temperature phase is ordered, but you're trying to find a reference liquid, that I can see is a challenge. But if you could actually find, an honest to goodness, the only reason you don't do scattering in quantum Hall is because you've got a 2D layer which is hard to get to. That's a technological restriction, not one of principle that you couldn't see in the excitation spectrum. I mean, quarks, which are a good example of fractionalized things, fine by scattering, even though the actual excitations eventually are not, right? I mean, scattering can tell you. So it's not, I don't think it's, if one had enough examples of that kind, we'd see it.
I mean, the only complication there is what Matthew started off with. I mean, if this sort of exotic thing is actually coexisting with some more conventional order, no, not necessarily, right, in the sense that in these cases talk about antiferromagnetic order coexisting with. So then what one has to look for is more subtle signatures, like what happens to the magnon line width as you go up in energy. So one practical question that I don't know the answer to is, you know, if we go back and examine all sorts of three-dimensional Mohr tensilators that at least most of us have assumed are boring, what do we know about empirically? Has the magnon line shape actually been studied carefully enough for us to know whether something interesting is going on or whether they're really completely well described by conventional spin rate theory?
No, he is not. Berkeley's his biggest system. You can't measure every single state. So, no, there's trade-offs.
Except, you know, like, if you want to, you probably know anything. There you go. Last thing that predicts stuff. Otherwise, you don't even know what you mean. That you can
claim it. I mean, the U1 case is whether a gap representation in the phone call, that's, like, it should be simpler, right? That's fine, because that will have specific heat signature. You're pretty optimistic.
I think if the phases exist, I mean, this would be something that would be like, you know, like, what kind of thing?
Yeah, Alan?
Yeah, on the follow, what Matthew said is it's really a shuttle phase in a wave function, and one way to see this phase actually is a dispersion relation in the Boolean zone, and usually in those kind of a strange phase, the spectral function, the lower edge of a spectral function, sometimes can have a periodicity which is like in a half a Boolean zone or quarter a Boolean zone. It's kind of reflection of this shuttle phase interference in the underlying wave function. So that's maybe this a lower edge of a spectral function could be one, you know, one place to look for this shuttle phase. Mainly really how to detect those phase in the Brownian wave function, really, I think it's a key. Yeah.
I think probably in the interest of time, we should go on to the conference summary, but I'd like to thank everyone who spoke up and made a contribution, informally or not. So thank yourself.
Let's thank the organizers once again. Too.
Yeah.
Ready? Let's turn it on.